This is Independent Librarian Dynamic, Sean Kennedy VI, doing a pirate broadcast of episode number 732.653.663.398.36.17. This broadcast being done in Queen's English from sometime after now. Time is not what you think it is. I'm broadcasting from your possible future so that you can try to prevent what's already occurred for me. By listening to this, you should be aware that you may be subject to enforced termination or mandatory recycling. You will be violating your creativity permits, and if you're recording this in any way, you'll be violating any of the creativity laws and licensing laws. By acknowledging you even heard this broadcast, you could lose your listener's license. Which means, in turn, that you would, you'd lose all rights to any kind of media, and the ability to even entertain yourself and educate yourself. If these notions should shock or disturb you, then I really do advise you listen because you need it the most. Light your candles. And with our prayers to Server, he will protect us. Been on the highways for a while now. Heading towards New Orleans. It's a long way to go. But if I stick on these roadways, I should be fine. These legs I got, they move me pretty good. And I was thinking, you know, as I was running, you get a lot of time to think. It's a lot more like driving than it is like running with these legs. But I was thinking that maybe people in the past might have thought that I was, you know, pretty tough now as far as being, you know, with cybernetic enhancements, my recon helmet, you know. And I suppose I have a certain survivability, but I'm not tough. I'm not, you know, a tough guy. I'm nowhere near a soldier. Most soldiers, the good ones, I mean, they just started augmenting the soldiers lately, but it's kind of goes against conventional thinking. But cybernetic enhancements on soldiers are not a good thing. I mean, yeah, great. These legs are relatively new and they allow me to move quickly, but if they break down, I'm pretty much screwed. I can't get any parts and they don't heal. Back in the day, the best soldiers, the really tough guys, were all bio-augs. They all had enzymes and whatever. Which reminds me, you know, you want to hear about someone who's a tough guy? I should tell you a story I heard. Had it reported to me about the Miracle Man of Vietnam. This was some kind of guy. Probably one of the tough guy stories from the war. A lot of people don't know, but there was two wars in Vietnam. There was the first war, which happened before the turn of the centuries, into the 2K mark. That was back in the late 60s, early 70s. It's often referred to now as one of the forgotten wars. No one even pays attention to it. But Vietnam, of course, is a hot zone because it's under China. And the Vietnam area, once, you know, the big red machine started to roll, that was a major battleground. They used it as a test area. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I should tell you about this guy. The Miracle Man was a guy named Johnny. And this kid named Johnny was from a lot of different conflicting reports of where this guy was actually from. But I know his name was John. And grew up in a farm. He was a farm kid from somewhere in the central states before the Dome Farms went up. And the thing about John, which was kind of interesting, is he was born with a condition known as giantism. But normally giantism is not that developed. People with giantism, you know, they either have big hands or a big head or forehead or whatever. It's not proportionate throughout their body. But this guy here had giantism on like 95% of his body, so he was close to, you know, 7 feet tall, a little bit over 7 feet, people say, and sporting near 400 pounds. And being a farm boy, well, he worked out huge, you know, lifting one hay bale with each hand and juggling them and stuff. I mean, he was just a complete machine, this guy. So, being a big guy like that, I mean, he was handy on the farm, but he wanted more than that. He was quite an intelligent fellow. So, Big John, he goes and he signed up for the Marines. And he joined in, and he excelled. And when he joined, there was the new weaponry, the new, they were getting away from, there used to be guns and whatnot in the Army used to fire what they call cased ammunition. There's cased and caseless ammunition. And cased ammunition is, you have like a brass casing with a bullet that fits into the casing, and there would be propellant inside of the case. So when you fire the bullet, it would explode and the bullet would fly out. But the guns we know of today, of course, are all caseless ammunition, which means it's like a little rocket. You know, the rocket loads in, it's got a solid fuel projectile on the back, and it slaps into the pipe and fires, which means that they could carry more ammunition because the bullets were actually smaller. Now, there's a lot of, whenever you change weaponry in any army, however, there's a lot of resistance to it, especially with something as standard as a battle rifle. So when Big John joined the Marines, they were just in the beginning stages of the switchover. Any unit, you know, meets with resistance, and so they weren't really keen to just go to these brand new fangled solid fuel bullets. So for a while there, they came out with kind of a dual feed rifle casing, where they had two settings on the rifle where you could either fire cased or caseless ammunition. And two settings on the rifle was jacketed, and retro rocket was what the first names of it was. So the slang term for it was, they'd call it, you know, they either had the rifle set on jacket or rock and roll, and you know, they'd go in. Now, the new rifles were bigger because they had to, you know, essentially have two barrels, and there were quite a lot of mass there, and there was a lot of concerns about whether a round, because some of them were explosive, would detonate in the pipe, and safety and all the rest of it. So they were quite large and quite heavy. Except for Big John, they weren't so bad because he could, you know, swing that thing around like it was nothing. So after doing well in the Army, he wound up getting going through a selection process, because bear in mind, back in the day, everyone wanted to be a soldier. Like, if you joined up to be a soldier, you wanted to be kind of a tough guy, I guess. You know, the young man dream of this being this badass or whatever. So he signed up and went through selection and got found to be suitable for enhancement. That's what they used to call it. Now they call it gen joking, but in the beginning it was called enhancement. So they did. Most of the enhancement at that time was for logistical reasons. Made you able to eat just about anything. You could eat foliage, or you could eat rotting meat. Changes your taste buds so you can handle it as well as your body to be able to digest it. There's a biological condition, apparently, that exists within certain people of different blood types where you can readily process meat more effectively than others. I can't remember what it's called, but apparently type O blood types have it more than anyone else. And because John also happened to be a type O, he was ideal for the process. So he got enhanced, and he was already huge, and of course they wanted to put him on, you know, steroids. So he went from a measly 400 pounds to 550 pounds inside of 6 months. And this time he was Big John. I mean, Big John was just like, I mean, he looked like a superhero, you know. Kind of guy who could lift up the back end of a car, probably the front end as well, with the right kind of car. Anyway, he was a big guy, strong guy, but personality-wise, he was always, he's professional, you know, as a soldier should be. He wasn't, you know, overly quiet. He just did his job, smiled a lot, laughed a lot. Fairly good-natured. He wasn't, being that big, nobody really tried to mess with him off. A few people did. It's funny, actually, the bigger you are, people, sometimes they want to try to prove something, so they try to, you know, slay the dragon. I don't really get it, but they do that. So, after we got modified. He was slated, if so chose, a lot of them after modification went with special forces teams. And the one he chose to go with wasn't actually a Marine team. It was an Army team, which they had to pull some strings to get in there. But apparently while he was doing some of his courses and training and modification, he hooked in with a bunch of Army guys. And they got him all switched on to join in to the Green Berets. So he did. He did a cross-genre with the modifications. You know, there was openings right across the board. Everybody needed everything, so they wanted to put people where they wanted to go. So he signed up for a special team. Well, some of the sub-teams, see, the Green Berets began to specialize. They have, like, Desert Patrol, and they have a whole bunch of different, you know, slots. Even the Green Berets now have some waterborne and urban operations and stuff like that now. And because of his size, he was too big to use in any kind of urban operation because he was just, you know, he's a monster. So he was somewhat limited. They couldn't put him into Navy stuff. Another reason why with the Marines is because, well, he's too big. He can't get into the boats, the small landing craft. I mean, yeah, he's great in a fist fight, but, you know, he's too big to put anywhere else. So his options were a little limited, but he wound up going to a sub-team known as the Boonie Rats. And the Boonie Rats are a special forces jungle operations team of the Green Berets, and that's all they do. They go out into the boonies and the bush, and they do long-distance reconnaissance patrol, a lot like the Pathfinders before the Pathfinders were created. This is back a ways now. This is just when before the war got us out of control. So he signed up and went through Boonie Rat training. And the way the Boonie Rats were configured is they worked in three-man teams. And he had a friend named from Texas who was known as Tex, ironically enough. And there was a guy named W.S. Taylor was the other guy. But they used to call him Whiskey Sam after his first two letters. So the standard two-letter of the team, Whiskey was a... Well, he was the comms guy. He was the you always had one technical and two general purpose. The technical was Whiskey. He went in and was the guy who did all the languages, knew like six languages, ran all the communications gear, was able to set up the logistics of the center. In a lot of ways, Whiskey had seniority over the group because he's, you know, he actually knows what's going on. Tex and Big John were, you know, they're... To say they're assault troops is wrong because it implies that, you know, what the Boonie Rats do is just purely fighting, but they go into an area and they make it friendly for forces. They train up, like, let's say, oh, like what they were supposed to do is they were going to go, the Chinese was, you know, they were walking all over Vietnam, so it'd be typical for the Boonie Rats to go in there, and Tex and Big John would ally all the Vietnamese people behind them and train them on how to fight against the Chinese. And by the time, if and when, you know, the states wanted to make a move, they'd already have a force ready to go, and they'd be able to finance this force to fight for them. And this was generally an involved procedure, like it would take years sometimes, especially if they were running like an underground movement, resistance, what have you. So although they weren't, Tex and Johnny weren't as technically trained in languages and whatnot as Whiskey Sam was, they were still, you know, they knew everything about warfare. I mean, two men could train 1,000 men. It's no small feat. So it's a very, very specialized team. So if you stood Big John, of course, between Tex and Sam, I mean, it was, you know, no contest. Tex was a big guy for, you know, a fair size, but he was nothing compared to Big John. So they took him, and he was the butt end of a lot of jokes between Sam and Tex. And they trained together, and the training for that operation was almost a year long. So by the time they went in there, it was pretty well trained. I've heard anywhere from 9 and 11 months. The mission that came down the pike, because they knew they were going to wind up going in, was that to go in and do a reconnaissance of the jungle in Vietnam. As the Chinese, of course, waited until the Middle East had blown themselves all sky high with bombs and then just started marching in on it, taking land basically unimposed. It scared the hell out of the United States. Now, for their weapons testing and training grounds, they used Vietnam, the whole country. The Chinese don't have a lot of respect for the Vietnamese, so they just went in there and dominated the whole city. The whole country was just taken over again, which is kind of sad for the Vietnamese because they've been pretty much kicked around for a long time. So, not that the United States has any love lost for Vietnam, but what happened was is that in Hanoi City, which was a major staging ground, there was a lot of combat. And because of the nuclear fallout, it was dark. There's huge radiation clouds that spun over the city, so there was no way to get satellites in and on the actual country of Vietnam itself, so nobody knew what was going on. But there was reports coming from intelligence sources saying that Hanoi City was in shambles. It was under attack. There was dead piling up in the streets. Nobody really knew what was going on, and the Chinese was, you know, sending soldiers down there. Now, the enemy of the Boonie Rats was a unit, the Chinese unit, which the Chinese name roughly translates out to Bamboo Snake. It was the name of the team, but they called them Vipers, the Bamboo Vipers. And they were a pretty hard Chinese unit. Now, China, of course, we had some people protesting genetic modification of soldiers over here, but in China, that was not, didn't exist. I mean, every single soldier of the Bamboo Vipers, although the Chinese were generally smaller in physical stature than North Americans, these people were all, you know, heavily trained combat troops, really, really tough, excellent shots, huge aggression drugs, baseline DNA modification, the works. Very, very tough troops. So that was the real resistance that they were expecting to run into, was the Bamboo Vipers. Now, the mission, when eventually did come down, they were trained in jungle ops, so they had to train another 3 months to be certain about what they were going to do. The plan was to get eyes on the ground. We were going to get ground intelligence there to see what was happening in Vietnam, to see what was happening in Hanoi City. But the primary thing was is that they had to do a reconnaissance of the entire country to see whether or not it would be feasible for the United States to set up an underground movement there to act as kind of a backdoor into China. Because China had dominated most of the Middle East, but they wouldn't really expect America to ally themselves with the Vietnamese and then funnel up and into the country through the back door. So, some book guys thought it up, and so soldiers had to go out and do it and see if it was possible. It was a dangerous mission, and it was going to be a mission that would involve them being gone for a long, long time. Sometimes troops are there 10, 15 years. It's a long time. And in the day and age we're in now, I mean, life expectancy, especially when you have to do battle with elite units like the Bamboo Vipers, I mean, it's there's a lot of unknown variables. Never mind all the toxics and toxins and mines and waste and God knows what that have been released into the jungle by the Chinese. I mean, bear in mind, this is a testing ground that they were going into. They tested all their really nasty, nasty things on a lot of the Vietnamese people. Of course, the Vietnamese people fought back against China. Oh, you bet. And they wanted to fight against China. There was, you know, all sorts of guerrilla movements against the occupation of Vietnam. But, I mean, you can't, you know, the United States wouldn't be able to stand against the big red machine, so the poor Vietnamese didn't put up much of a fight. Not to start with. I mean, Vietnamese are many things, but they are tough. You know, you can't say that those people are cowards. I mean, wow. There's all sorts of tales I could tell. I've heard about Vietnamese soldiers standing against, you know, thousands of Chinese Bamboo Vipers, and it's like, you know, they get murdered because they just don't have the edge of genetic modification. But they put up the fight, though. Right to the man. So I suppose there's something to be respected in that from a purely, purely technical sense. So the deployment was that they were going to be loaded into a couple of Sky Snakes. Now, what Sky Snakes are, is they're like a drop tube which is fired because the radiation... It's another reason why China wouldn't expect to have, you know, people come in through Vietnam, is it's a very hard country to get to after all the bombs had gone off and the drift due to the atmospheric conditions. I mean, there's no radio transmissions are possible out of Vietnam because of all the radiation clouds. The whole country has been shrouded in darkness for so long that weird things have started to show up in the jungle. Animals have started to change. Plus, with the radiation, their mutations are very common. You don't. It's like a. It never really gets above sort of a gray dark in Vietnam. And plus, you know, with all the fallout and everything, it's very rare to find someone who's not burned or damaged in some way. Anyway, one of the reasons why the Chinese would really expect it, it's very hard to get troops in there. You can't land a landing craft because it would show up on their radar. Any craft would just, you know, be seen. And although, yes, they do have a lot of very interesting ways to stop, you know, stealth technology and that now, you still have eyes and spotting towers and whatnot, and you got patrols that can see stuff, and there's just no way to get the manpower there fast enough. They couldn't be airdropped in because, again, planes would be seen. And even at max altitudes, they'd, you know, be spotted and engaged. And, the not so much the risk of losing the soldiers. I mean, yeah, they could send a fighter escort along and get them in there, but once they realized that, you know, these soldiers were there, they'd realize America was making maneuvers in Vietnam and the element of surprise would be lost. So they had to be delivered very quietly and with more than anything else without the Chinese knowing. And then the Chinese would have any Chinese that they encountered who discovered them. If they were discovered, they had to kill whoever they came in contact with. Otherwise, you know, it would be... It just wouldn't work. So they loaded them up with specialized equipment. You know, they had... it was debatable whether or not they should have used the MR-16s, but they did. And a lot of the different units had problems using the caseless ammo, but the Boonie Rats didn't. They were pretty specialized because they liked the extra ammunition, the ability to throw fire downrange. That kind of volume was very, very good to them. So they loaned it up for deployment in these units called Sky Snakes, which they called Rattlers for two reasons. One is a Sky Snake is not as cool sounding as a Rattler. And the other reason is because when you're flying in, it looks kind of like a glider, like a missile, crosswind missile and a glider would dropped from a bomber and then it would fall and then pop wings and it would automatically guided into a landing zone, which is pre-programmed, and it was a one-time use thing, so they were kind of cheaply made, and they were supposed to carry three soldiers, but because of Big John's size, him and Tex fit in one Rattler, and they had to put all their gear and equipment that was non-essential, other than weapons, into a second Rattler that was going to hold Whiskey Sam, because he had his tech gear for communications, because he had to set up a laser pole to communicate out with the ships. And there was set times in which they'd have to make it to the coast and do broadcasts, and it was very, very technical, because they can't do radio transmissions because of the radiation clouds. So time came for the mission, and the Sky Skanks got dropped. Big John and Tex in one, and Whiskey Sam in the other. Now, the way these units deploy is very specific how these units actually hit the ground. They had to assume that going in where they'd land in, the landing zone would be hostile. So, I mean, they were supposed to be in stealthily, but if something was reported, because when these things crashed down, I mean, they really did. When Rattlers came in, it was... wasn't as loud as like a missile strike or something like that, but you still got this you know, things smashing into the bush, so they had to assume that there would be enemy, or there could be a patrol that would know there. It's just the way that the Boonie Rats did things. So the way it was going to happen was is that the first Rattler would come in with John and Tex, and they would clear an area, because they kind of land close to each other. They cleared the area of any kind of enemy before Sam came in. All the technical gear, if it was compromised, Sam could splash the unit and be retrieved by sub, but if there wasn't a problem, then you know, they could carry on with the mission. So, it was the first real combat drop for Tex and for John. And although they trained for it for such a long time, and I mean, these guys, by the time they were done, and they had enough aggression, drugs, and size, they could have probably handled anything, but the first time you make a combat drop, it's always bizarre. Level of stress must be very high. So, they strapped in. The first one came in. Rattler smacked down in the bush. Out jumped John and Tex. 16's on. And they were sweeping the bush. Now, the jungle, you might think it'd be easy to hear things, but the jungle at night is not a quiet place. It's not like a forest. I mean, in the forest you can hear things for a ways, but there's always noise. Which is, in a way, helps them. In a way, it hinders them. It helped them because it would cover the sound of their landing. But it also prevents them from knowing if anyone's approaching. So one took east, the other one took west, and they fanned out. And it was Tex who saw them first. There was a patrol. As fate would have it, there was a Bamboo Viper patrol that was out, and they may have heard something, and I don't know if whether or not they'd heard anything. I imagine they didn't, because they would have radioed. Even still, I don't know what the range was because of the radiation storms. It was all done by runner. Maybe they would have radio contact, but the position wasn't compromised. And normally in a situation like that, they would simply hide. They wouldn't try to engage the Vipers, but the second one coming in and them so close, they had to put the drop on them. So, being close to each other, they used really high range encrypted throat mics. And the two of them took on about 35 Bamboo Vipers. They set themselves up and let fly with the rockets. That Kessel's ammunition, I mean, we're talking about, you know, projectiles that explode with the force of a shotgun shell after they hit you, doing about 3,500 feet per second. They just ripped into them. But the Vipers weren't ones to be taken lightly. Yeah, they killed 10 of them right off the top, but the other 15 turned into a firefight pretty fast. The training took over and the war was on. They weren't too sure exactly where they were because the Boonie Rats knew how to move under fire so they could make themselves appear like larger numbers. There's no way two guys are going to attack that many Vipers. It just wouldn't happen. But the sounds of combat drew in another enemy that they didn't know about. Nature has a way of finding the little flaws, the little errors that man leaves. When man goes and creates a nuclear condition, a dark, sweaty jungle. They make dark, sweaty creatures to live there. What had happened was is there was a kind of ape that lives in Vietnam. It's a lot like a baboon. And these monkeys were, they turned very carnivorous. And humans are quite easy prey because we don't have very tough hides. So these monkeys would hunt in packs, and the packs would grow quite large, to the tune of like 50 or 60 of these apes. And they learned very quickly that with the sounds of fighting, there would be fresh dead. And so they would amass, and like sharks, they would hang back in the trees, but sometimes with the sight of blood, they would try to move in. And there became a real frenzy, because then you've got these apes that are about the size of a baboon that are flexible as an orangutan and with fangs, and they would descend in on the soldiers. And that's what happened. By the time Whiskey Sam came in on his Rattler, the landing zone sure wasn't clear, but they weren't going to abort the mission. The monkeys moved in, and Tex and John pulled back. The Vipers wound up getting torn apart by the apes. They just swarmed on them. The Vipers stick together and fight as a unit, but when you're surrounded and the apes just start moving in on them, they were just a more viable target than Tex and Big John. And in the Animal Kingdom, having someone the size of Big John probably did a lot better, because they knew that they're still animals. They respect size. But there's more dead and a lot more blood over the bamboo vipers, so that's who the apes took. They swarmed up and fell on the Chinese like tree sharks. And as Whiskey Sam handed out the kit, all their equipment, and they loaded it onto their backpacks and got ready to run out of there, this terrible screams of the apes tearing through the bamboo vipers, this screams of men having their flesh rended, making a sound like madness slinging through the trees, and the apes screaming from wounded and hunger and death. And they ran, put as much distance between them. The rattlers themselves would decompose with the next rainfall. Within 5-6 days, there'd be nothing left of them. Very handy deployment unit. So it was up to Tex and Big John to make their way to find out, make contact with the locals. They knew there was a village nearby, and they knew that they had good intelligence that the village would have a resistance movement there. And with the Viper Patrol being in the area, that backed that up, because Vipers wouldn't patrol unless there was a reason for it, so they probably expected to encounter some sort of resistance. So they got their bearings. They had to shoot with a compass. The GPS couldn't get through, so navigation in a jungle at night and unknown territory when with magnetic anomalies from radiation everywhere is not an easy thing. But Tex was really good with his senses. He used to always joke and say that he was part Texas and part Indian. And sometimes he just wants to shoot himself. It's kind of a joke. Dark humor. So they headed through the bush for quite some distance. After 2 days of walking, they came across the village. And this was, although you got to bear in mind, this is the 21st century when all this was happening. This village was something, you know, it could have been a few hundred years old. There's people trying to live here with only minor modifications done since the fallout, since time began, really. I mean, you'll see a radio and people wearing semi-modern clothing, some medicine, but there are people trying to preserve their culture, living a life that, well, they've always lived in a time when the world doesn't care about you. It didn't take the Boonie Rats long to introduce themselves to the villagers. They went in there and bought food for the first little while, lived in the bush. Being very large white men, they knew, like the villagers knew, they knew that they were Americans, and they knew that they were enemies of their enemy, so it kind of made them their friend. There was a lot of anxiety amongst the elders having these American soldiers in the area, because the Chinese found out that they were, you know, getting supplied from this village, that they killed the whole village. But again, the Vietnamese people are not cowardly, so they wanted to fight. And if they couldn't fight themselves, then maybe they could help people who could fight for them. And it was about not long after they began talking to some of the elders and that, that the team met a woman named Ty. And Ty was a young woman, probably about 24, 25. Quite attractive, which is rare in a country as war-torn as that. But she was a fighter. And she was one of the major drawing forces to, well, to get the village to listen to what the Boonie Rats had to say. Whiskey Sam was in there and spent a lot of time discussing with the elders about why they needed to fight and the alliance and whatnot, and trying to gather information, none of which was easy to get. I mean, the villagers didn't want to say anything to the Boonie Rats. So the getting information was pretty difficult because you can't really, well, you can do some reconnaissance on foot, but it's very, very dangerous when you got a unit as switched on as the Bamboo Vipers. So they were kind of dependent on making friends with the locals. Now, although Ty had a lot of connections and a lot of ties, it didn't, the Boonie Rats would have to prove themselves in order to win over the villagers. And to win over one village meant to win over all the villages, because, I mean, village to village, news travels and things of that nature. So they had to do it quickly, otherwise they would, because quite rapidly the villagers would either determine whether they would accept the Boonie Rats or they would just shun them. And if they were shunned, well, you know, eventually some village would reap the rewards of turning in the Boonie Rats and they'd be compromised. So it was really all about what the indigenous people of the region thought of them. So they had to prove themselves. And Ty told them a piece of information. She didn't mean for it to be as big of a piece of information as it was, but she gave them a piece of information about how they could prove themselves. To do this, they had to go kill what was called the tiger. Give you a little background there. The tiger was a big, bad gen joke that went wrong for the people of China. They created a weapon using genetic modification that was human. It had the intelligence of a human, but, I mean, there was nothing. I mean, you couldn't even put this thing in clothes. It was a crossbred with apes and feral animals. They called it the tiger, the Chinese word for tiger, which, it was a killer, which, it was a biological killer. It wasn't a soldier yet. It was a beast with fangs and claws that was able to use weapons and machinery. It's the perfect thing as a, it's a super soldier, because you need to make a super soldier that looks like a man, or you make a super soldier that looks like the beast. That's what the Chinese did. They created this prototype super soldier known as the tiger. Then they dropped it in the jungle of Vietnam to see how it would do, because that's their testing ground. And when it did that, when it dropped into the jungle, it decided to forget everything it had ever learned about friend or foe and just decided to go completely feral, and it began to kill and keep killing. Cleaned out a few villages and started heading towards a major metropolitan center, which happened to be Hanoi, the city of Hanoi. It made its way into Hanoi and began murdering the populace en masse. Now, you got to think that, okay, well, this thing is, you know, this monster is a beast, right? But how many people can it kill? Well, you're forgetting that it knows how to use weaponry. It knows how to use guns. It knows how to use bombs, explosives, escape and evasion techniques, tracking, high speed. It knows how to poison. All it does is kill. It was able to set up biological weapons and bombs. It was able to salvage munitions from the jungle and build weapons. And it murdered most of the population of the city of Hanoi. The psychological aspect was brutal. That's why there's so much activity that was reported out. People were running out of the jungle, or running from the city of Hanoi into the jungle. And with all the dead, the apes began to move into the city of Hanoi as well. The whole place began overrun with monkeys. The Bamboo Vipers would go in, but I mean, with the monkeys feasting on the dead and attacking those who are still alive, it's a very, very deadly scenario. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, this bad Jen joke running around trying to kill you, just waiting for more to engage more hostiles in his downtime. It's just killing everything it comes in contact with. Now, in and amongst the villages, the tiger had become, you know, a terror. It was unbelievable. But Ty told the Boonie Rats about the tiger. And if they could go take it out, the villages would follow them. It wasn't ideal, but it was the best scenario they had. If the villagers had asked them to kill a bunch of the bamboo vipers, the bamboo vipers would be aware that there's an American presence here. But to actually take out something that had gone wrong, like the tiger, they wouldn't be tied to the same... The bamboo vipers would claim credit for it, because that way they would get the reward. Bamboo vipers wouldn't be aware of who actually took out the tiger. They would accept that they'd done it themselves. Some unit would come across it, claim credit for it, and then that would be it. That's if the monkeys didn't wind up tearing the thing apart anyway. So it was a perfect way to prove themselves to the people of the region. And so that's what they had to do, and that's what they did. So they suited up. They had to get Hadaway by navigating. So Ty said she'd go with them. So their three-man unit turned into a four-person unit with Ty, Tex, Whiskey Sam, and John. Hanoi was 3 days' journey from there through the jungle, through monkey-infested jungle that became more monkey-infested the closer you got to Hanoi. But that was the journey. The village elders knew what they were doing and probably didn't expect them to return, but they respected it. So even if they died in the process, the villagers would be more receptive to the next batch of Boonie Rats. So Whiskey Sam made a broadcast using one of the lasers, hit one of the ships, and got the message across, let them know what they were going to do. And they set out on through the jungle. They didn't want to take Ty with them, but they really had no choice. She was a better guide on the ground than Tex was. And he had to admit that the journey would be faster if they did it. For the time that they spent, the less time they spent in the jungle meant less time they could come in contact with the bamboo vipers. There'd been some activity in the area, but they'd been able to stay low. Getting closer to the city of Hanoi, there might be a larger chance of it because the vipers would be out on patrol looking for the tiger. It's very hard to find one killer in a city abandoned and filled with, well, bloodthirsty apes. 3 days later, after traveling through the bush, they came into the city of Hanoi. It's amazing how quickly the jungle will take back what was taken from it. The plants in the darkness began to grow like some weird mold around the city, taking back roads and street signs. There's explosions and shelling everywhere. The bamboo tigers and Chinese forces bombed the city when they knew that the tiger was in there because they just wanted to kill it, so they shelled their people. There's people murdered everywhere. There's bodies all over the place. Approaching the city, they got in through the outskirts first. They could see a few bones, remnants of carcasses laying about. But as they made it into the city core, they could see the dead rot piled along the sides of the street. The monkeys would drag people out of the city and closer to the edge of the jungle. Men, women, children strewn carcasses. It was a sight that was born of madness, but the smell is the thing that scarred their soul. It was the stench of rot and burning, and fires were still burning in the city from gas lines that just didn't seem to end. And the gray darkness from the clouds above, and always keeping the city into perpetual twilight with blood smears and skulls and heads and scraps of flesh torn about. I mean, it was unbelievable to see. Further into the city they got, the more the piles of dead grew. They began to find the dead hooked up on primitive racks, crosses. These was classic psychological military tactics that the Tiger had come through and hooked people on rebar jutted out from buildings, let their corpses rot. Birds had come through and torn away at them, and still they very carefully patrolled through the city. At night, while they searched in the city, there was one person always on watch. They were all very thankful for Ty then, because she was another set of eyes. The others would try to sleep, but you could always hear the monkeys screaming. With the concrete, it would just echo through the city. The fires burning. Once in a while, they'd hear screams that weren't ape. Some survivor, someone who hadn't left the city, had been caught. The way the monkeys would do it was they would drag the person, cripple them, break them somehow, injure them, and then drag them out into the street so that the pack could tear them apart. They used their fangs only for tearing flesh. They wouldn't risk busting a tooth fighting humans, so they would beat them to death. Or they would grab them with their arms, and one human's arm would go one way, one human's arm would go the other way, and they would just pull them apart right there. Took a while and they'll die like that. If you were lucky, you'd get knocked unconscious first and the apes would pull you apart, but if not, you got to be alive and conscious with these screaming monkeys tearing you apart. Tex, John, and Whiskey had seen it before. Villagers got lost that way. Children were mostly playing inside. They couldn't go outside. Apes would prey on them. They could be shot easily enough. They learned to stay away from people with weapons, but they were deadly. They spent 4 days in the city of Hanoi. 4 days there. They'd been on the ground about 3 months by this point. And now looking for the Tiger is not a pleasant prospect. So Whiskey Sam got the idea to detonate some C4, a building they found at a critical point to cause the building to fall down. The explosion would probably draw the attention, and, well, the Tiger might come to investigate. Investigating that, they could stage up some kind of a fight. The moisture in the air doesn't actually damage concrete, it actually reinforces it, so they had to use a lot of C4. And it being a jungle region, there was a lot of moisture. Night and day, they were always sweating and hot. There's no escape from jungle, especially with cloud cover, especially with radioactive cloud cover. And the heating is just beyond. So they strapped up the explosives. The plan was that, well, they would use enough C4 to knock the building down. Whiskey Sam would hang back because he was the best shot of the bunch. He had special caseless ammo that would be used for a sniping roll. Could be loaded into a standard battle rifle, so they hadn't had a chance to use them too much yet, so they took this opportunity to, well, try it out on this thing. They loaded it up, set the C4, and it'd be up to Tex and John to try to engage this thing so that Whiskey Sam could get the shot off. The problem with soldiers is not that they're tough. The problem is that they're hard to see hard to spot. The tiger was well trained in how to stay hidden. So, with the amount of dead that had piled up in the city and the lack of activity in Hanoi that they'd seen, he'd hopes that the tiger'd run out of ammo. Because if it had run out of ammo, it would, it would have to use physical means to kill them. Which means that, it'd have to come out of hiding. It couldn't just snipe anymore. Which made it a more stand-up fight. So they set off the call, blasted the C4. Ty hung back with whiskey, and Tex and John made their way out into the rubble. Living bait. They set the explosion off in the morning so they could get the better part of the day, even though the day was not much to see. And as the day passed, they moved around, staying a little bit more in the open than they should have, so that if the tiger was there, it could see them. It was painful for them to be walking around. They wore their armor in case the tiger did have a weapon. But it was hot and painful. The tiger did see them. But it waited. It waited until just twilight before it moved in on them. Given the choice between the two, John was so big, so the tiger opted to move in on Tex. They were walking about 500 feet apart, staying in the sidewalks, when a manhole flew off and a clawed arm came out and grabbed Tex by the leg. His claws dug in like a cat, hooked around the meat of his leg. Tex was no small man, though. He grabbed hold of the arm and let a scream go and swung his cannon down, but the tiger was expecting it. When he swung the rifle around, he caught the barrel, snapped it off, and that was a tug of war. Tex braced his one good leg against the ground and began to pull, trying to drag this thing out of the hole. The tiger didn't receive any fire because, Whiskey Sam was waiting for a clean shot. Big John ran over. The tiger saw the shape coming, so he did the only thing he could do. He let go. He released Tex, let him fall to the ground. His leg was all ripped up. It was bleeding really bad. He vanished back down the sewer pipe. John came over and grabbed his friend Tex, dragged him away from the hole. Immediately started doing first aid on him, otherwise Tex was going to bleed out right there on the ground. The tiger was John's size at least. The wound was ripped open. Terrible gash. It snapped off his thigh bone like it was not even there. John was so busy doing the first aid, he didn't realize that the tiger hadn't run. He just wanted to see how many others there were. It came up out of another manhole, and John didn't even see it coming, and ran up behind him and hit him, sent him flying. He must have flew about a good 35 feet and landed on my street corner where there's a bunch of rubble. His rifle was down beside Tex when he got hit. The tiger, which, to describe this thing, was manlike in a way, looked more like a gorilla with a huge toothy maw, like some kind of feline ape, massive gorilla thing with flexible hands. I guess that's why they called it the tiger. Grabbed hold of John's weapon, but John's weapon was biochipped so that only he could fire it. It was a new technology that had saved his life. It took the tiger a couple of seconds to figure out that the weapon wasn't working. John was groggy. He began to stand up, and he looked down to see his friend Tex, who he trained with for a year, having his entire head torn off. by the great jaws of the tiger. His face collapsed, and his whole skull gave way, and the tiger just pulled his head off, choking off his scream. At any moment, John expected a shot to ring out. He expected Whiskey Sam to fire that round, kill the tiger. He looked over and he could see Whiskey Sam was going crazy. His rifle was not pointed at the tiger. He was doing a drill. He was doing a weapon-clearing drill. Something had gone wrong with the shot. He'd find out later that the caseless ammunition, being a solid propellant, it wasn't tested in a jungle environment. And the sniper rounds, having been stored for a long time, the moisture had affected the propellant and it didn't ignite properly. So, Whiskey Sam had to try to clear the jam and get his rifle working so he could get the shot off. But the tiger, well, he'd already killed Tex. And unless Big John engaged it, it was going to vanish into a hole again and they wouldn't get another chance. So his action was clear. In the rubble, John saw part of a stop sign, the pole. One end of it had a sharp, twisted spike. The other end was pinched closed and made about a 6-foot-long steel pole. John stood up, grabbed hold of this pipe, and came walking over to the tiger. The armor wouldn't do any good anyway, so as he walked, he dropped his armor in the middle of the street. And now it was a man with no shirt on, huge, versus a genetically modified nightmare in the street. Tiger knew there was no one else there, or so he thought. Otherwise, he would have been shot. Why else wouldn't somebody have fired by now? So with Tex's blood all over his face, he stood up and bared his fangs at John. The two circled. And John was strong, but I mean, he was genetically modified, but not to the level that this thing was. This wasn't even man anymore. This was a feral killing monster. Made a lunge for John and caught him in the chest, but John was able to angle his body forward so his feet took the brunt of the hit. He was able to stay up, but the tiger threw one arm up and caught him just in the chest, part of his neck, dug his claws in deep. John brought that pipe up and swung it around, caught the tiger in the side of the head. The pipe bent slightly, but it was able to hold. He hit that tiger hard enough to stop traffic. But he stayed on his feet too. John was dazed and bleeding. The tiger was dazed as well. Maybe it was luck. But when the tiger swung and John swung it again, John connected first and knocked the tiger's blow. The tiger fell down, and John, rather than striking at his head again, moved in to struck at his feet. Caught him at the ankle with the pipe. There's a shattering sound, a dull thud ring against the pipe as his ankle gave way. And then, just like he was swinging a hammer when he would knock the post in on the farm, he brought that pipe up and began to swing it down on that tiger, on that genetically modified freak. His torso would stand up to a lot of abuse, puncture wounds, but a huge steel pipe smashing down on you again and again, swung by an injured soldier who just watched it, one of his tight friends get ripped apart. The tiger bared his fangs again, and John swung the pipe into them, shattering his teeth. He kept swinging that pipe down. The tiger knocked the pipe away on a swing, caught it with his hand, pulled it from his fists. But John had done too much damage by now. He wasn't going to stop. The tiger tried to, lunge at John again, but he caught him by the jaw. His teeth removed. There's just broken splinters. He grabbed a hold of the tiger by the jaw and began to punch at his face. If he could just hit him hard enough, he could crack that skull. He began to driving with both his hands the tiger's skull against the pavement on the street, smashing it again and again and again. After a lifetime, the back of the tiger's skull gave way. All of John's back and shoulders and arms were clawed, but the tiger's brains were splattered against the street. And Whiskey Sam never even got the shot off. He stood up, blood running over his body, and looked back over to Whiskey Sam, who by this point was halfway to him. He dropped the rifle and tried to help. He was so far away, though, that it took, he was almost 3 blocks away. The fight was over in a matter of moments. By the time he got there, he was amazed with the power that John had shown. He ran up. I looked at John, covered in blood, and he'd beaten to death a genetically modified monster by the Chinese that had murdered an entire city. Whiskey looked at him and said, "It's a miracle you killed that." And it was. He'd beaten to death a creature which had murdered an entire city. And after that, John became known as the Miracle Man of Vietnam. He's in bad shape, though. He'd come through a bad fight. But that's probably, from what I know, the best fist fight story I'd ever heard. The ending of it is that John got patched up, stayed in Vietnam for a year, training the locals, training the people. The villagers all signed with the Boonie Rats after that. And he and Whiskey Sam trained the beginning forces of the entire, the army that was raised there to fight against the Chinese. That was the beginning of a long and bloody war. Whiskey Sam, it became a part of his life to fight against the Chinese there. But John, he went home after a year. Ty and John became a bit of an item. She wound up coming back with him. John had had enough of war. So, after a grand total of about 7 years in the army, he got out. Now here he's a farmer now, with his wife. And they got kids. That's a long time coming, though. Whiskey Sam, he stayed on in Vietnam for another 20 years before he wanted to come home, but by that point, he was so deeply involved in the intelligence scene over there that the country wouldn't let him go. America wouldn't bring him back. It took him 25 years before Whiskey Sam was finally able to come back. But all that time, John and Whiskey Sam were friends and stayed that way. And I heard that after Whiskey Sam got out, he lives on the farm with Ty and John and the family he created. So I guess there's kind of a happy ending to the story, if you can call someone living in a war zone training people to kill other people for 25 years a happy ending. I guess if you make yourself invaluable to a military organization, you can never leave. Makes you wonder what the difference between being a prisoner and job security is. Well, that's all from me. I figure I'd just touch base and let you folks know another story from the after now. This is Independent Librarian Dynamics, Sean Kennedy VI, doing a pirate broadcast of episode number 732.653. .663.398.36.17 in Queen's English from sometime after now. Thanks for listening. These broadcasts help keep me sane as I'm traveling on this crazy mission. I don't know what else the highway has in store for me, but once I get to New Orleans, I'll broadcast again. Please tell others what you've heard today and tell others about the coming war, about the things that are going to happen. Even in Vietnam, that's probably closer to your time. And in doing that, you'll help me. Please. Please help me.
Hello, Well, I got a friend named Whiskey Sam. He was my boonie rat buddy for a year and now. He said, I think my country got a little off track. Took him 25 years to welcome me back. But it's better than not coming back at all. Many a good man I saw fall. And even now, every time I dream, I hear the men and the monkeys in the jungle scream. Drive on, it don't mean nothing. My children love me, but they don't understand. And I got a woman who knows her man. Drive on, it don't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing. Drive on. Well, I remember one night, Tex and me rappled in on a hot LZ. We had our 16s on rock and roll, and with all of that fire, I was scared and cold. I was crazy, and I was wild, and I have seen the tiger smile. I spit in a bamboo viper's face, and I'd be dead, but by God's grace, drive on. It don't mean nothing. My children love me, but they don't understand. And I got a woman who knows her man. Drive on. It don't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing. Drive on. It was a slow walk in a sad rain, and nobody tried to be John Wayne. I came home, but Tex did not, and I can't talk about the hit he got. But I got a little limp now when I walk, and I got a little tremolo when I talk. But my letter read from Whiskey Sam, you're a walking, talking miracle from Vietnam. Drive on. It don't mean nothing. My children love me, but they don't understand. And I got a woman who knows her man. Drive on. It don't mean nothing. It don't mean nothing. Drive on.